Good afternoon. If we may have your attention, we welcome you to Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary, and I see that there are quite a number of you who are interested in war, and we welcome you to a symposium on the subject, and I think it is an appropriate time for us to do this since our nation is poised on the brink of perhaps another conflict, and there are times when we need to reflect very deeply on the Christian teachings regarding war and peace. And so we're delighted to have you here today. I just wonder how many of you are not related to the Southeastern family. You're not a student or faculty member. You're a visitor on campus today. Let's see your hands. Fine, quite a number. And we welcome you. We're so happy to have you here. Let me explain two or three things to you very quickly. I'm Paige Patterson, for those of you that are visiting, and my purpose today is to be the moderator and perhaps even a questioner myself at a place or two. And then you'll notice that we do have microphones here at the front, and at the appropriate time, you will have opportunity to address questions to any member of the panel. It's my joy to introduce the panel to you today. And then we're going to have a presentation, a relatively short presentation, by two of the members of the panel. And then the four are here for you to ask any question that you want to. And in good Baptist tradition, I want to tell you, you don't have to agree with anything that they say. As a matter of fact, as far as I'm concerned, you can go after them. And one thing that we will do is we will be sweet, but we may be straight. And so everybody just keep that in mind, but you're welcome to ask questions. Please identify yourself as you come to the microphone. I tell our students here, you have to learn to ask questions properly. And the way to ask a question properly is to say, I'm Paige Patterson. I would like to address my question to Dr. Daniel Heimbach. And then you address the question, whatever it is, that way. He does not have to reply to, hey, you. He can speak to you individually if he wishes to do so. Our panel today, our very distinguished panel, begins with Dr. Richard Land, immediately here on my left. And Dr. Land is the president of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention. And a graduate of Princeton University, New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary, we wish Southeastern, and also DPhil from Oxford. Then we have next to him, all the next three people are faculty members here in the area of ethics. And so we have Dr. Daniel Heimbach, then Dr. Lederbach, and then, as I told the students this morning, you have to have Bach in the last part of your name to teach in the ethics division, so we have Dr. Jonesbach. And these three ethicists are all very gifted and capable young men, and we are so happy to have them here. I should tell you this about Dr. Heimbach, who will make the first presentation in just a moment. Dr. Heimbach actually was in the first President Bush's cabinet, or not cabinet, but on his staff, as a speechwriter, and particularly wrote many of the documents relating to just war theory to assist the president at the time when Gulf Storm took place. And so he is experienced in the area. Dr. Land's also had a great deal of experience in the area, and we're grateful for all of these. And Dr. Land coming all the way from Nashville today in order to make presentation. A couple of things I need to tell you. We prepared for 400. We had no idea that so many of you were interested in war. And so we're grateful that so many of you are here, but that means we ran out of programs. Now, you want a program? They'll have them. We're reproducing them back there right now. When you leave, there'll be a program available for you, introducing these four men to you. Also, there are materials that they have. Dr. Heimbach has prepared some materials. Obviously, we've run out of those. Dr. Land has a very important letter addressed to President Bush that he is making available to you. We've run out of that, too. But if you didn't get one, you want copies of those, they will be available at the end, okay? And so with that in mind, we're going to have our presentations. And first of all, I want to recognize Dr. Daniel Heimbach of our own faculty and ask him to make the initial presentation on Christian view of a just war. Dr. Heimbach.
Thank you very much and welcome all of you. And I'm not quite sure what to think when Dr. Patterson said that you can have at us, but just make sure that it's just if you do. One small correction at the outset in terms of my previous experience and association with the former Bush administration. My role was not as a speech writer. I was a policy advisor, as Deputy Executive Secretary of the Domestic Policy Council, and then was Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Navy for Manpower for the last 2 years of the Bush administration. But did have the opportunity to, in a backdoor way, because from the title you can tell that I was in domestic policy, although I'm a Naval Academy graduate, Vietnam War veteran, and had specialized in the ethics of war in my doctoral study, just happened to be in that position at that time as things were building up, and there was growing criticism as to whether the president was doing the right thing, just like what's happening right now. And internally on the staff, we were discussing it, and I was suggested that it would be a very good idea if someone wrote a memorandum for the president discussing just war principles, because he was, as far as I was concerned, taking measured steps that were following those lines, but did not have, was not using the language and the terms for those who are familiar with it. And there was a lot of concern in the public that the president had not given a reason to send Americans that far around the globe. And some of the staff were mystified as to what he meant. How could they say he wasn't giving reasons? Because there were press releases going out, statements going out all the time giving reasons, diplomatic reasons and jobs and oil and stability and international order and things like this. But the word still was that the president hadn't given any reason for sending. And so I was explaining to some of them who weren't quite sure what in the world people weren't getting the point, that what they were saying was they were looking for moral justification, and that would it would be good to specifically address that. And so because of that, I was Governor Sununu, who was the chief of staff, said go ahead and do that. So I wrote him a memo on just war principles, and he was very pleased with that and decided not only was that helpful, but he wanted that to be the framework of a national address on the moral framework of what he was intending to do. And that became a very well-known speech that he made. A little story, insight, when that happened, that was sent to Kurt Smith, who was a speechwriter, to put together this speech, and with the memo that I had written to use that as an outline. And so I called down there to see. I want to make sure that he was doing a good job and didn't mess it up. So I called down there to see what was happening, and he just got it, and he said, "What is this just war stuff?" And I said, "Well, it's been around for a while, so it just interesting." So anyway, we worked through that, and one thing led to another. We're here. You're here because we are interested primarily in the relevance of just war theory to the general question of the morality, maybe, of what is happening with regard to tensions with Iraq, between the United States particularly and Iraq. And I'm going to address that. But before doing that, I want to clarify a couple of points on what just war doctrine is, and then I'll make some comments of what I think, at least, on the moral issue of war with Iraq. First of all, is that just war is biblical. Not everybody understands that, or maybe not everybody agrees, but I would argue strongly that just war is a biblical ethic. I respect Christian brothers who take a pacifist position. I think I don't agree that they're taking the right position in terms of biblical interpretation, but if they hold that position because they believe that that's a biblical position, I think they're very worthy of respect, and I certainly do respect them for that. But the just war approach to the morality of war has been the majority view of Christians through church history from the very beginning. It's not, I would hold, a corruption of being faithful to Scripture, but rather is inherent and is, in fact, present in Scripture. We see that because war between nations, we are told, is something that is going to continue on through to the end of history. There never will be a time when, through human effort, we'll be able to stop it. The conditions of war will always remain up until Christ returns. Secondly, using the sword or the use of a threat of deadly force to maintain justice is a divinely appointed responsibility of rulers, both in the Old Testament and in the New Testament. The military profession is not treated as corrupt. It can be used badly, but just being a military professional is not a morally tainted profession. And so it leaves us, if we are going to accept those points in the Bible, with a moral tension on the morality of war in the Bible. On the one hand, There's a moral obligation of kings or rulers to defend justice, to defend the weak against the strong, and so forth, and to punish wickedness. On the other hand, there's an obligation to seek peace as much as possible. So if we're going to take both sides of that tension, and we can't ask the question, how can a moral person ever go to war, which is the pacifist question, but rather, when is it moral to go to war, and how do you fight a war morally, which are the two questions that frame a just war ethic. When is it moral to go to war, because you don't want to go to war wrongly, and when it is moral to go to war, then how do you go about using force in a moral way? And I can point to several places through Scripture where specific just war principles are very clearly put, in Deuteronomy, for instance, and in Amos, and even Jesus mentioning one that we could talk about. The second point, not only is just war biblical, but just war is not only biblical, it's classical. The Western tradition of just war, which has been the main ethic of war in Western civilization, also comes from classical Greek and Roman sources. Early practice in the Greek city-states and then picked up by the Roman civilization and practice, not only in practice but in doctrine. Some of the most well-known just war principles, like the principle of just cause and last resort and sparing the vanquished and proportional use of force and so forth, predated even Plato in the 5th century BC. And the first one on record to actually use the term just war in writing that we have a record of was Aristotle in the 4th century BC. So although early Christian theologians like Ambrose and Augustine developed just war and talked about it as Christians, they did not start it. Rather, they had learned just war principles and just war moral thinking in their classical education, and then as theologians saw or believed that it fits with scriptural evidence. So the just war ethic in Western civilization really has both a two roots, a classical root and a biblical root that have come together. A third point is that just war is a developing and always has been an evolving ethic of war. There's no single person who is the authority in just war. There's no single book that is the Bible of just war. And so when it comes to an actual situation, it's always debated as to what the right principles are, as well as how they should be applied. Some early principles in just war tradition have dropped out of use. Used to be a very big deal that just war meant that you never hid or deceived your enemy. You never ambushed. Ambushing was somehow immoral. That kind of dropped out after the American Revolutionary War. Used to be that it was thought that you never were allowed to fight on Sundays or on Fridays or on any holy day in the church calendar, that was against just, well, that's fallen out of just war tradition as well. And other principles have been added in more recently, like the probability of success principle, which really didn't come in until the 16th century. So the just war has been an evolving tradition. Moving closer to the understanding the current situation, current debate, there are two key issues that I think are important and two key concerns. The two, I think, most important issues right now where we are contemplating possibly using military force actively against Iraq. The two main principles I think that are most interesting to discuss is, do we have just cause for war with Iraq? And the second one is, have we reached the point of last resort? Now, those are both just war principles that need to be met if it's going to be right to go to war. In relation to those two, just cause and last resort, which are the two, I think, most important principles to discuss, there are two concerns that I have in understanding what they mean. One is the problem of possibly taking just cause and interpreting it in such a way that it goes too far and in so doing turns a just war ethic into a crusade ethic. There's a lot of confusion, always has been, between where just war ends and crusade begins as a completely different ethic. And if you take just cause in an idealistic way and say that war is justified to accomplish some kind of ideal justice, then you turn just war ethic into crusade. The classical just war understanding of the just cause principle requires actual wrongdoing, not just fear of what might happen, but actual wrongdoing to be just cause. A second concern is related to the last resort principle. And that has to do with the possibility that the last resort can be taken so far that it turns just war into pacifism. Pacifists obviously have every right to discuss the morality of war, but their position is that war is never right under any circumstance. So really, pacifists don't have any say in interpreting what just war principles are. The last resort principle, classically, is not a timeless thing. It assumes reasonable opportunity to respond in terms of the other side, where there's tensions, but it's not timeless. If it's taken in a timeless way, there's always more time. You can always have more diplomatic missions. You can always debate some more. You can always send the inspectors back over and over again. And if there's no time deadline, you can turn last resort into an endless thing that you never get to, and then it really turns just war into pacifism. So those are my two concerns right now in our discussion, not turning just war, the just cause principle, interpreting that in a way that turns just war into crusade, and not taking the last resort principle and turning just war into pacifism. Now for my views on war with Iraq, a couple of things. I do believe that that there is just cause for war with Iraq right now. But I do not agree with all the reasons that I've heard mentioned by some, and some of the reasons being used right now, I think, are unjustifiable reasons. The reason I think that there is just cause to go to war with Iraq right now, the clearest one for me, is enforcing terms of the surrender of 1991, which was the close of the Persian Gulf War. Terms of surrender there, Iraq agreed that they were, in order to bring the fighting to an end, that they would get rid of all their weapons of mass destruction, nuclear as well as chemical, and they have never complied with those terms of surrender. And so we have every right to go in and enforce those terms of surrender, and from that point of view, the just cause leading to the Persian Gulf War, the invasion of Kuwait, still applies to using force against Iraq right now in terms of enforcing the terms of surrender, which they have not complied with. On the idea maybe of starting over again and treating this as if it's a brand new war and looking for a justification to start a new war, which I don't really think it is, but if we wanted to look at it that way, it's not so easy to find a just cause, at least not so convincingly. Now, support for terrorism aimed at the United States would certainly be a just cause for a new war, if that's what we're looking at. And I, in fact, think that President Bush has shown adequate proof that there is such a link between what Saddam Hussein is doing in Iraq and Al-Qaeda and so forth like this. But many others are not so convinced, and because of that, it creates it doesn't create a moral problem for me, but it creates a political problem in terms of support, because the president needs a convincing support to lead a war effort effectively. For that reason, I would recommend to him and anybody else that we not be relying on focusing on proving a link between what Iraq is doing and support for terrorism, although I think it's there, because it's not so easy to convince folks that it's clear, because the clearest justification without question is enforcing the terms of the 1991 surrender. That is unquestionably justified. There are some reasons that have been mentioned as possibly just causes that I do not agree with. Because they are actually turning, I believe, just cause into crusade. I do not believe that war is justified to prevent a possible attack, because it does not involve actual wrongdoing. The potential of wrongdoing is not the classic way of understanding the just cause principle of just war. And if you interpret just cause that way, you're using war to accomplish a sort of ideal, and that is exactly what the crusade ethic is. I also do not believe that war is justified to achieve regime change as a purpose of war. That is, that's within just war ethic. The purpose is to correct a particular wrongdoing of injustice, not to humiliate or to conquer or to take over. And regime change is a category of conquering. It might be an effect. That would be a wonderful effect, but it's not a legitimate objective or purpose of war within the just war. If that's the argument being made, then I would argue that that's a form of crusade. That's not just war. On last resort, I believe that we are actually way past reasonable last resort. I think that President Bush has been extraordinarily restrained. And as far as the United States is concerned, which goes back further than the current Bush regime, since the Persian Gulf War, 12 years, the United States has been extraordinarily patient, much more patient than is morally necessary in terms of keeping Iraq accountable to uphold the terms of surrender. Now, last resort, interpreting what's reasonable, depends, I believe, on clear communication and opportunity for the other side to do the right thing. It does not depend on how the wicked respond. It doesn't depend on signs of progress. And I think it's an error to get bogged down in delaying the idea of reaching last resort because there are signs of progress, or you know, somebody is teasing a little bit and a little bit there, a little bit that. Have they had a reasonable opportunity to respond? Have they done it? Yes or no? We've reached last resort. I think hesitancy past reasonable last resort is actually immoral. Failure, it's a failure of duty to defend justice, it extends wickedness, and it allows the wicked to manipulate the situation. So in conclusion, by just war terms, I believe that Iraq is actually doing wrong by not keeping its promise to destroy weapons of mass destruction, and I believe that President Bush has a moral duty to go to war to enforce terms of the 1991 surrender. And just to mention a couple of Bible references, because as a Christian, I believe everything we do needs to be in reference to Scripture. As Christians, we must, according to Romans 14, verse 19, make every effort to do what leads to peace. We don't desire war, don't hope for war, and we should seek peace. But it doesn't mean peace at all costs, because the Bible also says, and God makes it very clear in Isaiah 56, 1, God commands that we maintain justice and do what is right, particularly if you are a government ruler. And in Proverbs 2, verses 7 through 9, God promises to bless those who do both of those things. Quote, he holds victory in store for the upright. He is a shield to those whose walk is blameless, for he guards the course of the just and protects the way of those who understand what is right and just and fair. Thank you.
Dr. Heimbach, and I forgot to mention to you that we have to actually have four different universities or schools represented in the terminal degrees. I mentioned Dr. Land with his DPhil from Oxford. Dr. Heimbach holds a PhD from Drew University, Dr. Lederbach from the University of Virginia, and Dr. Jones from Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. So we have four different institutions represented. Dr. Land, thank you for coming all the way from Nashville, and we give it to you.
Well, thank you. I actually came from Washington. I'm going back to Nashville, but it's a delight to be here. It's always a delight to be in an academic setting. And I was reminded as I was coming here of the evaluations that came back from the Baptist history class that you let me teach this last June. And anyone who thinks that you can please all the people all the time should read student evaluations. I taught a one-week class, and the evaluations ranged from this course changed my life, and this course has made it certain that I will never be anything but a Baptist, to I don't know what Dr. Lamb was teaching, but it wasn't Baptist history. So I'm liberated from trying to please all the people all the time, Dr. Patterson. I do try, although sometimes it's not evident, that to do my best to please some of the people some of the time. I do have a letter that I brought with me, that more copies are being produced, that all of you should be able to have a copy, that I wrote and was signed by myself and by Chuck Colson and Bill Bright and Dr. D. James Kennedy and Dr. Carl Herbster, that we wrote to the President on October the 3rd, in which we stated and laid down the criteria for just war as we saw them, and that we agreed that all of the criteria for just war had been met. I agree with almost everything that Dan Heimbach said, and Dr. Patterson left out one of the most important parts of his resume, which is that he is a graduate of the United States Naval Academy, and thank you for your service to our country, Dan. And I also want to say thank you to all of you who have served our country. and defended our freedom. I want to thank you as a grateful citizen for your service to our nation. The only thing I think that he said that I would probably disagree with is I think regime change can be a legitimate aim of just war if the regime is evil enough. I think that removing Hitler from power was a legitimate aim of just war theory. I think that Saddam Hussein, whose personal hero is Joseph Stalin, the other mass murderer of the 20th century, and a man who has shown absolutely no respect for anyone's life but his own, and who has committed numerous war crimes, I think that a legitimate, not by itself, but as part of an aim, would be to remove him from power and to bring him to justice before a Nuremberg-type trial for crimes against humanity. I think that Dan has put his finger on two of the more controversial, debatable issues about whether just war theory applies in this case, being just cause and last resort, and I think he has answered them both convincingly. Another one that has come up in my debates on this subject and allows me to tell my episode with the first Bush administration. And that's the question of whether or not the war is authorized by legitimate authority. That is a primary requirement of just war theory, that the resort to lethal violence, which is what war is, must be authorized by legitimate authority. No one has a right to privately sanction violence. Our forebears understood this when the American colonies came to the conclusion that the British government was no longer a just and legitimate government. They wrote a Declaration of Independence in which they spent most of their time enumerating the ways in which the government of Great Britain had ceased to be a legitimate government, and they were replacing it with another government, the Continental Congress, and it was the Continental Congress that authorized the use of force to resist British oppression. They did not take the law into their own hands as private citizens, but as a new government, and decreed the reasons for that legitimate government. And the reason that that's a controversial issue is there are many people in our society today, particularly many critics of the war, and including, I would have to say, the U.S. Catholic Conference of Bishops, who believe in just war theory but don't believe that all of the criteria have been met. One of the criteria, they would argue, is that it must be sanctioned by the UN. I could not disagree more with that assessment. The legitimate authority for committing American soldiers and sailors and airmen to battle is the Congress of the United States of America, not a UN, a General Assembly, not a UN Security Council, period. Now, just before during the period between the invasion of Kuwait and the time the Gulf War started, I was in my office in Nashville working on another issue, and I got a phone call from an assistant to the president, Leanne Metzger, and Leanne said, she asked me a question about another issue, and then she said, well, what do you think about the situation in the Gulf? What do you think about the war? And I said, well, I'm very concerned, because if the president goes to war to liberate Kuwait, and he hasn't gotten a joint resolution from Congress, I will go into the streets and demonstrate against him. Well, she nearly dropped the phone. She said, you'll do what? I said, I will go into the streets and demonstrate against you. I said, Leanne, you're not as old as I am. Let me tell you something. I have a little league classmate who died in Vietnam. I have a high school football teammate who died in Vietnam. I have several friends who were hurt badly in Vietnam. And I couldn't do much about it then. But I made a solemn resolve, and a lot of us in my generation have, that never again would we allow our government to put our soldiers at the long end of an uncertain tether unless there was sufficient agreement and commitment at home to give them the tools and to give them the support to allow them to do the job. And if the President of the United States wants to liberate Kuwait, and I believe he should, then he's got to make his case to the American people and get a joint resolution from Congress, which is the only legitimate authority for the American government to wage war. Well, she said, can you write that down for me? And if you can write it down and get it to me, I'll get it on the plane with on the helicopter to Camp David with the president this weekend. And I said, well, I'll try. This was 10:30. She had to have it by 3:30. So I wrote a real short memo laying out the criteria for just war, focusing on the question of legitimate authority, and sent it to her. And what she did with it, I don't know. But I think that there were numerous people that were supporting Dan's comments within the administration that, you know, war, when James Baker said this is about jobs and this is about oil, that doesn't resonate with the American people. What Iraq did to Kuwait was very similar to what Mussolini did to the Ethiopians when he just up and attacked them and took them over. And the League of Nations dithered and dallied and did nothing, and they were then consigned to the ash heap of history. And I think the president has made a very prophetic statement. What's at stake here in the debate that's going on is not the credibility of the United States. What's at stake here is the credibility and the relevance of the United Nations. And if the United Nations does not support the coming military action that will be taken by a coalition of the willing, if not by the UN, then the UN will have decreed its own irrelevance to what happens in the 21st century. And I know there are varying opinions about that, but they will have decreed their irrelevance. I think that the president's policies do meet all of the criteria for just war theory. And one thing that I learned my just war doctrine from Paul Ramsey, who was a professor at Princeton University when I was an undergraduate there. He did a lot to try to apply just war theory and just war doctrine to counterinsurgency warfare. I would recommend his books to you if you want some to do some additional reading on this. His books, War in the Christian Conscience and Just Wars, are two excellent volumes. I warn you ahead of time, his prose can be a little dense at times, but it's worth the effort. And Dr. Ramsey said to me, and I'm reminded of this as I watch the National Council of Churches and others as they wring their hands and run around in circles on this issue. You know, Bob, I was being interviewed by National Public Radio, and the reporter said, well, Bob Edgar, who's the head of the National Council of Churches, he said that only the fundamentalists are for this war. And I said, well, compared to Bob Edgar, everybody's a fundamentalist. And, you know, I mean, the National Council of Churches has raised relativity to an art form. I'm amazed they've managed to summon the certainty they have that this war is wrong. I didn't know they were ever that certain about anything. Paul Ramsey said that oftentimes when he watched the mainline churches as they dealt with these issues, he said they are guilty of what's called anticipatory reconciliation. And he said, what I mean by that is they just assume that their opponents are nice guys, misunderstood, because they have lost from their theological vocabulary a concept of evil, that there is true evil in the world. Men are not basically good. The Bible tells us that the heart of man is wicked, that we are sinful, and there are truly evil people in the world, and there is true evil and malevolence in the world. This just seems to be beyond the cognitive grid of the chattering classes, or the National Council of Churches, sometimes called Americans United for Separation of Church and State at Prayer. He said, you always assume that the other guy has a point, that he's a nice guy, he can be reasoned with, and what have we done to offend him? And Dr. Ramsey concluded by saying, that's not the way that adults do foreign policy. Martin Luther King once made this comment about Dietrich Bonhoeffer. He said, if your opponent has a conscience like Gandhi, then follow nonviolence. If your enemy has no conscience, like Hitler, then follow Bonhoeffer. Of course, Bonhoeffer had been a pacifist, finally came to the conclusion that it was his Christian duty to participate in the plot to assassinate Adolf Hitler, to remove a monstrous evil from the world. And I think that we need to remember that, and we need to remember what John Stuart Mill said when John Stuart Mill said, war is an ugly thing, but it's often not the ugliest thing. An uglier thing than war would have been a Hitler-dominated world. An uglier thing than war would have been the triumph of the evil empire in the Soviet Union. I was in a debate with a German bishop recently, and he was basically saying that force was never justified. And I said, well, you know, that's an interesting perspective from the people who cheered Ich bin ein Berliner. It was a credible threat of the use of force that means you're speaking German now instead of Russian, because it was a credible use of lethal force by the NATO nations led by the United States that maintained the freedom of Western Europe against the evil empire for half a century. The resort to lethal force authorized by proper authority is sometimes the price human beings pay for living in a moral universe. Thank you.
Very much. Now, Dr. Lederbach, I'm not going to occupy all the time asking questions, but I do have about three that I want to pose to the panel, and I want to address this one to you, if I may. Give us a little perspective on this from a distinctively Christian perspective. How does this relate to everything else it means to be a Christian? And I think you even maybe have something to put on the screen for us to look at.
I do. Slide number 7 back there, guys, would be helpful at this point. Let me just say that I have no previous experience with either of the Bush administrations, like my colleagues here. However, at my home, we often do plant bushes, and much more importantly, and to the point, is I do pray for my President Bush, and hope you do as well during this time. It's an amazing responsibility that he has, and indeed, it's our duty as Christians to pray for him. And so I think one of the questions that oftentimes is not asked when we discuss just war theory is, what are the gospel implications for Christians to be thinking about in regard to war? Now, I have to be very careful in how I state what I'm about to say, because as Dan Heimbach next to me here has pointed out, we have to be careful as Christians to not slip into what we would call a crusade mentality. What I mean by that is that it's never right to use force to try to coerce somebody's conscience or their religious beliefs. That's an error, that's a mistake by which Christianity in the past has gotten into some trouble, frankly, and I think scriptures bear out that it's not a wise thing to do. I do think there are two vital questions that must drive us as Christians to think through, and those are the two represented on the slide over my head here. What is the human person's only true hope for peace? As a Christian, we are compelled to ask this question. Ultimately, Psalm 20, verse 7 says, "Some may boast in chariots, some may boast in horses, but we will boast in the name of the Lord our God." And as Christian people, we must keep forward and first in our minds that military might will never solve the problems of this world, nor will they solve the problems of the human heart. It's only by placing faith in Jesus Christ that anybody can ever have true peace. In the book of Romans, the Apostle Paul wrote, "Therefore, having been justified by faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ." And so there alone is the place by which somebody can find peace. However, the second question that I think is important for us to consider as well is, how should concern for the gospel drive our thoughts and our perspectives along this lines of war? Dr. Heimbach, I think, brought up the crucial issue. Much of whether or not we go to war with Iraq right now, or I should actually say that a little bit more clearly, whether we engage in military conflict with them right now, depends on how you understand this war. If you believe it's a new conflict, a brand new war, then we have to go back to ground zero to establish whether or not just war criteria has been met. I think Dr. Heimbach is exactly right that in 1991, the criteria was met in full, and so what we're now engaged in is a process of enforcing the treaty of surrender. And because of that, for the last 12 years, we've had no compliance at all. I think we can see very clearly that just war criteria has not only been met, but we're now in a new place as a result of this. Because of what's going on here, you see the need for this regime to be disciplined, if you will. So one of the ways I think it's important for us to maybe consider or to think about this issue is to use a parent-child metaphor. Imagine, if you would, you come home, you're a father, and you come home and you find that your child, your son, let's say, has roped up the next-door neighbor's kid in the middle of winter and started spraying that child with water. What would your responsibility as a parent be? Well, you would probably do something along the lines of free the neighbor's kid, right? Hopefully you would do that. You would also then perhaps discipline or chastise your own child, but you would probably also set up rules by which your own child's behavior should be modified. And indeed, you may never let them play with the other neighbor kid unless there was another adult there. So imagine that that's the scenario. You've set up, okay, you're not allowed to play with a hose, you're not allowed to play with ropes, and you're not allowed to be near the neighbor child alone. And then 4 months later, you come home and you find out that not only does your son have unwound the hose and is turning on a spigot, but has got plenty of rope out there and has indeed perhaps even engaged some of his friends to help beat up the neighbor kid. In that case, what's the responsibility? Well, the hope would be that a wise parent, would discipline the child. Now, here's the key to these two questions above. How does a Christian think about this kind of discipline? A child needs to be disciplined, but hopefully in a parent-child situation, you are never just going for compliance. My desire as a parent with my own children is that by helping them to comply, that they might find themselves in a place where they now have the ability to rethink the way that they view the world. And at that point, then, a Christian's job is to pray, not to force through use of arms, but to pray and hope that the just war criteria has set whoever's being disciplined in a place where they can reevaluate their worldview, where they can come, if you will, underneath a view of God's goodness that's appropriate and moral, and hopefully underneath the lordship of Jesus Christ. So we as Christians, I believe, in facing this issue, need to be praying not for compliance. Ideally, that would be wonderful, but far more importantly than that is that there would be a heart change that would go on among the people of that part of the world and among the leader in particular. We as Christians know from our own heritage that the Apostle Paul was an enemy of the gospel, and yet God saved him radically, and he became a missionary for the cause of Christ. I think it's incumbent upon us as Christians to pray that Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein not only come to Christ, but would begin to pass out Bibles in their home countries. That's the thing that a Christian needs to be praying for, and that's our duty. That's the way a Christian wages spiritual warfare.
Well, thank you very much, and I have just two questions that I want to address to any panel member who would like to answer them. This week's Time magazine, which is available to you now, has an article by Time's Theologian of the Year, Dr. Stanley Harwas, from our sister institution, Duke. And the article is entitled, "No, This War Would Not Be Moral." And panel, whoever wants to take it, Dr. Harwas makes an important statement here. He says, Bush's use of the word evil comes close to being evil to the extent that it gives this war a religious justification which Christians should resist. For Christians, the proper home for language of evil is the liturgy. It is God who deals with evil, and it is presumptuous for humans to assume that our task is to do what only God can do." End of quote. Now, panel, three of you at least, and one by, I gather, solid affirmation so far, have in effect endorsed the idea of a just war. But Dr. Harwas says there is no such thing. And indeed, you men happen to be Baptist, each of you, at this point in time, and hopefully forever, but you are. And consequently, a large part of your tradition is found in the radical phase of the Reformation, the vast majority of which was pacifistic. Why on earth can you men not trust the providence of God? Is it not the case that God is all-powerful? Is it not the case that he is quite able, better able to deal with Saddam Hussein than in fact we are? And after all, whatever you might say about the United States government, however noble it may be, it has about as much difficulty with it as it does nobility. And so why on earth would we undertake a thing like that? Why can't we just trust God in such matters?
If you want.
All right. I'll take a stab at it and then let Dr. Heimbach. First of all, interestingly enough, the leaders of the Reformation more thoroughly embraced just war theory than even Catholicism did in the 16th and 17th centuries. Calvin and Luther thought it was a great thing. Not all the Anabaptists were pacifists, and some of them adopted pacifism as a defense of last resort. I mean, it was their only hope of having any survival at all when they were being attacked in an unjustified way by both Catholics and Protestants. And of course, Dr. Patterson, while the Anabaptists are a part of our tradition, they are not the majority part of our tradition. The majority part of our tradition is English Puritanism, and they thoroughly and completely accepted just war theory and theology. Dr. Hiawass has a real problem, and that is that he says that he doesn't believe that war is ever justified. And, of course, in the 20th century, we have the best argument for war, Adolf Hitler. Adolf Hitler, if there was ever a just war, it was the war against Adolf Hitler. And, yes, God is certainly capable of doing anything that is not inconsistent with his character. He is sovereign. He is so sovereign that he can even choose to limit himself. And in the Bible, he says to through the Holy Spirit to the Apostle Paul in Romans 13 that he has ordained the civil magistrate to punish those who do evil and to reward those who do that which is right, and that they thus bear not the sword in vain. And that the word for sword there in Romans 13:4 is the word that was used for the sword of capital punishment. For Roman citizens who were found guilty of capital crimes. And certainly the United States government is not a perfect government. I wouldn't even call it a noble government. It's a government. As governments go, it's better than most, but it certainly is not to be made the repository of righteousness and holiness. Having said that, there is no moral equivalence between us and Saddam Hussein, any more than there was any moral equivalence between us and the Soviet Union, and any more than there is moral equivalence between Israel and the Palestinians. Are the Israelis perfect? No, far from it. But it's the other side that's sending suicide bombers in the name of their God to kill civilians and paying rewards for doing so, not the Israelis. There is no moral equivalence between Arafat and Sharon. And I think that Hiawass has a real problem there. And I think it's fascinating that Time had someone who's a pacifist criticizing just war doctrine. That's like having a dentist evaluate a medical school.
But Dr. Land, surely, you have just admitted the fallacy of your own argument. You have said that the Romans passage refers to capital punishment. Mm-hmm. All the difference in the world in a society punishing a member of its society that perhaps is guilty of a capital crime of some kind, and taking a whole nation into war against another nation, which, as a matter of fact, has no chance of winning that war, is defeated at the outset, and inflicting untold misery upon the citizens of that country. Why can't we just trust God?
Well, you have conflated several arguments there. I'll try to unconflate them. First of all, I think that Augustine was right in using the Romans 13 passage. I think that that Aquinas was right in using the Romans 13 passage. I think that Calvin and Luther were right in using the Romans 13 passage. Yes, the primary application is to the civil society, but it nowhere limits it to that. It gives the use of lethal force to the divinely ordained civil magistrate, and surely I would not want to be the one to have to try to defend the argument that it ends with the nation's boundaries and would not cover a lethal attack or evil intent from outside. So I think that it's clear that Romans 13 passage does justify the government in using lethal force to punish evildoers against the citizenry, both domestic and foreign. And when it comes to people dying in Iraq, fewer people will die as a result of our military activity there that are dying there now or will die there in the future. That's another one of the points of just war theory, is the question of proportionality. Will the end achieved justify the means or the cost? And I personally believe that we will either have to deal with Saddam later, when he is far more dangerous, with far more dangerous weapons of mass destruction, including nuclear weapons, or we will have to deal with him now. We can deal with him now when there'll be a relatively less cost to both us and to the Iraqi people. And I might add, by the way, and this is just a personal guess on my part, but it's an educated guess. My personal guess is that when we do get to Baghdad and we do start poking around in the archives and we do start laying out for the world all of the tunnels that are filled with gruesome and lethal weapons of mass destruction, we're going to find that the reason the French and the Germans don't want us to go there is the French are the ones who gave them most of their atomic technology, and the Germans at inflated prices, sold them most of their weapons of bioterror, at which point I'm going to turn to the Germans and say, again? Again? Wasn't Cyclone B enough?
Dr. Heimbach, can you help me out? I am still unconvinced by Dr. Land's argumentation. I have it in my heart that I trust God more than I do Dr. Land. And can you help us out any, Dr. Heimbach?
I'd be delighted. But if I could persuade you, I would truly need another job. So anyway, there were a number of things to respond to that are intriguing. And so let me, I guess, go in reverse order, because you did mention Stanley Hauerwas and what he said in that article, and then we jumped to something else. So maybe we'll come on back to that. But in terms of the response, you know, the idea that there is a responsibility of government, God gives to rulers to use deadly force, including the situation of war, not just capital punishment. I agree with Dr. Land that is an included part in Romans 13, but there's a whole lot more in the Scripture on the responsibility God gives to rulers in using deadly force in war, not just in domestic situations. For instance, in Psalm 82, verses 3 through 4, God, who is, of course, himself the King of Kings and Judge of the universe, orders or assigns the moral responsibility to human rulers to, quote, defend the cause of the weak, because to rescue the weak and the needy and to deliver them from the hand of the wicked. And that is also applied in the situation of war. And that God requires it. So that's part of the answer in terms of why not trust God. The answer is I do trust God. God is certainly capable of intervening and doing all, you know, anything he wants to do. But it's God's choice to assign us to participate in promoting justice in this world. It's the sort of thing, it's similar to, for instance, the fact that Jesus Christ, God incarnate, could heal at a word anybody he wanted to. Why didn't he just simply wave his hand and heal all the sick people in Israel of his day, or in the world of his day? He just healed the ones that specifically came to him, specifically asked him at that time. And he wants us to be reaching out to those in need and to helping, even though he could simply do it by a wave of the hand himself. Same thing with evangelism. You know, God could do all sorts of things that would go far surpass current technology, as great as we think it is, to bring the gospel all over the world to all sorts of people, but he wants us to take it. So it's not a limitation of God. It's because God wants to use us. And one of the things he's done is assign to human rulers the responsibility to promote and uphold justice in his, you know, for his sake. He could do it himself, but he wants us to do it. And he promises to help. So it's not a lack of trusting God that means, you know, when we support the idea of just war and the rulers have that responsibility, but rather that is God's choice to use us. So I guess that's really not so much a disagreement with you, because I think I know where you come from yourself. But really, some of the, you know, our pacifist Christian brothers.
If I can press that just a second before you go on, though. It seems to me that your analogy commits the basic fallacy of mixing apples and oranges, because both the therapeutic and the soteriological analogies that you've used have to do with saving life. It seems to me that war has to do with killing. And so it seems to me that the analogy is not well taken, and that where we're attempting to be the assistance of God in saving life, anybody would say that's noble, I would hope, but to kill people that we don't know for sure whether they're really deserving of this? How can we be the avengers of God's justice?
Well, war, Dr. Patterson, war is to save life. It is to, you know, we went to war in World War I and World War II to save life. We went to war in 1991 to save life. And if we go to war this time, it'll be to save lives. It'll be to save the lives of those who will be killed with weapons of mass destruction. It'll be to liberate the prisons. It'll be to bring to justice one of the great war criminals of the late 20th and early 21st century. And, you know, the biblical standard is not peace at any price. The biblical standard is justice. It's a just peace. And, you know, I would argue that the motive for war is to save lives. You know, I think Martin Luther had it right when he said, I'm not certain I have the right to use lethal force to save myself, but I am certain I have an obligation to use lethal force to save you, to defend you.
Dr. Heimbach, in fairness to you, I come back to you. I promised I'd let you finish, and I apologize.
Well, that's fine. Thank you very much. Well, I agree with Dr. Land. Which is to say that he did not accept your distinction, and neither do I. I think it's a false distinction to say that with one of those the other analogies have to do with life and trusting God when it comes to the use of lethal force has to do with death as a different category. What I'm talking about is the moral responsibility to trust God in terms of moral behavior. And it's a moral responsibility to uphold justice. And so that doesn't put it in a different category for me. But moving on, the only other point I wanted to do is to come back to Stanley Hauerwas's point that was in the Time article, which really was taking issue with anybody other than pacifists being entitled to use the word evil. And I wanted to deny that or reject his suggestion there as though it was not proper to use the word evil because all three ethics of war, just war, crusade, pacifism, are very concerned with evil. But they respond to it differently. And so pacifists define any violence as evil. So by definition, going to war is evil because evil is defined as violence. The Crusade views war as an instrument to bring about some kind of an ideal order in the name of God, and to just simply use war as a way to get rid of anybody who opposes it, because they see it as evil to compromise, to have anybody who disagrees with their view of God or a perfectly ideal society as worthy of living, and so they want to get rid of them. Just war shares the pacifist presumption against the use of war as a preferred means, that going to war is not the desirable means to use. You want to avoid war as much as possible, but it disagrees with pacifism in saying that in the current situation, because evil is real in the world, that sometimes it's we need to use force as a last resort to resist evil. So we want, you know, the use of force is not itself an evil thing. It's an instrument that can be used, that should be used. Of course, it can be used evilly, but it may sometimes be the moral thing to do, to use force to stop evil, the perpetration of evil. But it's a limited effort. It's not an ideal effort, because that takes you into the crusade effort. So I think Hauerwas is wrong to suggest that it's wrong to use evil, either because you're not a pacifist or even to use it in the secular world, because evil is not only a religious term. It's a religious moral term. It's a moral category. And I would argue that every moral category depends on a religious point of view. So there isn't any morality that's not religious.
All right. Now, here's what we're going to do. I'm going to let any other member of the panel that wants to respond to that very briefly. But as they are doing so, if you have questions you want to ask, I want you to quietly come to one of these microphones. You may begin to go there now. And any other panel member would like to respond to my question, because, frankly, Dr. Land and I have had this disagreement for a long time. It's amazing to me that a man of his erudition can make the mistake of feeling that Baptists have their primary origins in English separatism, when clearly the Anabaptists of South Germany and Switzerland comprise the major contribution. And so I'm amazed at that ignorance on his part, but be that as it may, we shall leave that and go on. But is there another panel member who would like to help me out, because I still think we should leave it to God?
In Matthew chapter 5, which is always a wise thing to do, to hear what Jesus said himself, he says these words, verses 39, I won't read through 48, but that's the full context. At 39, you have heard it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but I say to you, do not resist an evil person, but whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn to the other, turn and offer him the other also. And then in verse 44, you have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy, but I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you.
I think it's wise for us to take into account these passages of Scripture and say they should modify the way we think. We should not be warmongers. We should care to be careful in the way we express neighbor love. However, this is just a thought experiment. Actually, Dr. Land might have heard this in his classroom since he studied with Dr. Ramsey years ago. Dr. Ramsey took a passage from Luke chapter 10 and talked about the Good Samaritan, and he posed this thought question. What would have happened if the Good Samaritan had come down the road a little bit earlier and found the men actually beating the man and watched this take place? What would his moral responsibility have been along the lines of neighbor love? Now, and put this in your terms, think of if you come home one night and you find someone beating your spouse or your children, what does neighbor love demand of you? That's a great question. So while Dr. Hiawass might be able to argue that perhaps on a personal self-protective level, I'm not allowed to protect myself, I would argue that neighbor love compels me to get in the way and compels me to be involved in the conflict at some level. And so I think it's important for us to make a distinction between maybe perhaps we do have a call by Jesus to think about whether or not I defend myself, but I think neighbor love can be used to understand this is why I get involved on behalf of others.
All right, and thank you for reading those scriptures. That's my point exactly. We should return good for evil and pray for those that despitefully use us, not bomb them to death. Now, you wanted to say
you
real
know,
quickly.
I do remember Dr. Ramsey posing that in class, and I remember my response. I said, well, first of all, we should prosecute the government for not having the police there, because under God's order, the police should have been there patrolling the road. And he said, you know, I never thought about that one before. That's a pretty good answer. My own belief is that one thing that Jesus would not have had the Good Samaritan to do would be to sit by and hold the coats while the robbers beat up the victim and robbed him. I think neighbor love requires you to be willing to use whatever force is necessary, up to and including lethal violence, to defend the defenseless.